From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a behind-the-scenes look at The Simpsons from the show's creator, Matt Groening. Also, we remember novelist, essayist, and critic Susan Sontag. She died of leukemia yesterday at the age of 71. We'll play excerpts of two interviews with Sontag from our archive. We'll also remember actor Jerry Orbach. He died last night of prostate cancer at the age of 69. We'll listen back to an interview recorded before he starred in the TV series Law & Order. Orbach also starred in the musicals The Fantastics, Promises, Promises, and Chicago, and the films Prince of the City and Crimes and Misdemeanors. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush made his first public statement today about the Indian Ocean tsunami disaster, promising that the U.S. will continue to provide assistance beyond the $35 million it's already pledged for relief efforts. More from NPR's David Wellna.
The president summoned reporters at his ranch in Crawford, Texas, to make a statement about the tsunami catastrophe. Those reporters had repeatedly asked earlier why the president had remained silent on the disaster. He apologized today, not for that silence, but instead for disrupting the reporters' day.
I felt like it was important to talk about what is going to be one of the major natural disasters in world history. And it's important for the world to know that our government is focused and will continue to respond to help those who suffer.
The president also reacted to a United Nations official who'd called wealthy nations stingy, saying he was very misguided and ill-informed. Mr. Bush called the United States a generous, kind-hearted nation, and while he said more assistance will be provided to the disaster area, he did not say how much more. David Wellna, NPR News.
So far, the disaster has claimed at least 77,000 lives. California is dealing with record amounts of rain from a massive Pacific storm. Fred Eckert of the National Weather Service says Los Angeles got more rain than it's seen in decades, but other parts of the state got even more.
We had over 5 inches of rain with this storm as it moved on into the area. That's right in the city. But, of course, places to the east in the mountains, some places had over 10 inches of rain.
The heavy rain has caused flooding and mudslides that have blocked some roads and downed power lines. Ukraine's Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych has appealed to the Supreme Court, contesting his defeat in the country's repeat presidential election. He contends that the election was marred by widespread irregularities. Yanukovych tried to hold a cabinet meeting today, but he was blocked by supporters of Viktor Yushchenko, who won the election. NPR's Lawrence Sheets reports from Kyiv.
Opposition demonstrators banging steel drums blockaded Ukraine's main government building. They forced Prime Minister Yanukovych to cancel a cabinet meeting inside. The opposition says Yanukovych's appeal to the Supreme Court is a stalling tactic, and it accuses the government of looting, sending millions of dollars of state funds abroad during its final days in power, something the government denies. Political observers say Yanukovych's Supreme Court appeal stands little chance of success, since Yushchenko's margin of victory was over 2 million votes, and because international observers said the vote was fair. Yanukovych blamed his defeat on Western powers, whom he claimed had plotted to overthrow him. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Kyiv.
In stocks, the Dow lost 25 points to close at 10,829. The Nasdaq was down a fraction to 2177. This is NPR News. Oil prices rose today after another spate of violence in Saudi Arabia. Islamic militants attempted to bomb the Interior Ministry in Riyadh, the capital city, and fought gun battles with police. Officials say at least 10 people were killed, most of them militants. And the price of crude oil rose by nearly $2 a barrel in New York. Sales of existing homes in the country soared past analysts' forecast to a record annual rate in November. And the sales were helped by low interest rates and job growth, but the housing market varied in different parts of the nation. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Existing home sales jumped up 2.7% last month, according to the National Association of Realtors. That was a much bigger jump than economists expected. And the new numbers suggest a much healthier housing market than some recent weaker figures about new home construction. Wellesley College housing economist Carl Case.
Interest rates have stayed low, and a lot of people have been anticipating that they're going to go up. So that tends to attract people in who are afraid they're going to get frozen out of these low rates.
But while U.S. home sales were up between 2 and 6% in the South and West, the Midwest saw a more modest gain, and sales in the Northeast fell 1.3%. Carl Case blamed weaker job growth in the Northeast and high home prices. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Thousands of people in Ohio remain without electricity 6 days after a major winter storm. The state's largest utility, American Electric Power, says it hopes to restore power by tomorrow to most of the 14,000 customers who are still in the dark. That's down from more than 350,000 customers who lost power in the initial storm. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're ending the year with some of our most entertaining interviews of the recent past.
March, what's my blood type?
A positive.
Oh, nuts. Extremely rare blood, and I don't have it.
You know his blood type? Romantic.
My mother knows everything about her family.
Oh, yeah? What's my shoe size?
4B.
How many teeth do I have?
16 permanent, 8 baby.
How many hairs on my head without looking?
Oh, homie, you have lots of hair. Why did you want to know your blood type?
Oh, old man Burns is going to kick off if he doesn't get some double O negative blood, but nobody at the plant has it.
Bart does?
Woo! Yes! All right! Woo! Congratulations, boy! You've got a date with the needle.
Hey, wait a minute.
The Simpsons is one of the funniest shows on TV. As Jordan Raphael wrote in the LA Times, The Simpsons not only paved the way for a rich collection of primetime animation shows, it raised the bar for all TV sitcoms. We're going to hear from the creator of The Simpsons, Matt Groening. Groening also created the animated series Futurama and draws the syndicated comic strip Life in Hell. Before he started cartooning, Groening was a music critic. When I spoke with him a year ago, I asked how his vision of the characters had changed since he created the series.
Here's the problem with doing a sitcom which has lasted more than 300 episodes is you're trying not to repeat yourself. You're trying to surprise the audience, and you're trying to keep everybody who works on the show surprised. As a result, the show has gone off in some very peculiar directions. Sometimes I was alarmed. I was going, oh, my God, we can't do this. We can't do this. And then it turns out to be okay. It's funny, it's crazy, and it's the show is so fast-paced. We learned as we went along that we can cram a lot of jokes in there. So if there's a joke you don't like, just wait a fraction of a second, and there'll be another one to come along to replace it.
You said that there were things to which you said, we can't do this. What's an example of that? Because let's face it, The Simpsons does a lot of satire about homosexuality, the church, violence on television.
At the beginning, virtually anything we did would get somebody upset. And now it seems like people who are eager to be offended, and this country is full of people who are eager to be offended, they've given up on our show. So if you're bothered by The Simpsons, by now you know to tune out. And so we don't get that much problem anymore. We do sometimes with advertisers. We got into trouble a few years ago for Homer's watching an anti-drinking commercial, and it said, warning, beer causes rectal cancer. And Homer responds by saying, beer. Fox didn't want us to do that because beer advertisers are a big part of the Fox empire, and it turns out that the writer was able to track down the actual fact where some study showed that indeed it does, or did, or has a tendency to. So we were able to keep that in. But they want that's the kind of thing we put up with.
One of my favorite episodes is where Homer goes to rock and roll fantasy camp. It's kind of like baseball fantasy camp, but instead of being on a fantasy baseball team, you're in a rock and roll band, and you know he's taught how to be a guitar hero, and like Keith Richards and who else was in the
Mick Jagger?
Mick Jagger, yeah. Elvis Costello, their voices.
Elvis Costello, Lenny Kravitz, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun. You know what's great on this show is because we basically can get pretty much whoever we want to. And for a while, we weren't able to get older Hollywood stars, but then their grandchildren started telling them to do the show, so we've gotten some of them, too. And that's how we got Ernest Borgnine and Sting. No. Kidding about Sting. Sting said his kids liked it. That's why he did the show.
Were you in on the writing of the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp episode?
I think I was I think I stuck my nose in the door, but the writers definitely deserve credit for the show. The show has so many things that need to be taken care of. The writing is the least of our problems, and so I run around. I work on the editing for a little bit, and sometimes the writing and the designs but not on that particular episode. I don't think I had anything in there.
Tell me more about what your job is now.
I'm the spokesmodel for the show. I do fresh air interviews, and what I do is, like I said, I stick my nose in where I think it's needed. Uh-huh. I'm there at the beginning of the process, and I'm there at the end of the process. And it's most fun on Thursday mornings when the actors all get together around a big table on the Fox lot and read and perform the script for the first time. Well, the writers furiously scribble notes and mark little check marks on what gets laughs and what doesn't. And then we rewrite the script. And then 6 months goes by with storyboards and animatics and character designs and re-records and rewrites and all this stuff. And at the very end of the process, there's a final edit and a final sound mix of the show. And it's amazing how many times the show really doesn't come together until that last part of the process, which is the final sound mix, which is one of my favorite parts of the whole thing.
Why do you love that part?
Well, because you can take something that if you watch silently would not get a laugh. And if you, with the right sound effects and the right music and the right pauses, actually you can pull comedy out of something that didn't seem to be there. We had once, a few years ago, we had a vicious fist fight between Homer and Smithers. I know it's hard to believe that Homer and Smithers would fight, but they did. They got into a fist fight and were hitting each other over the head with blunt instruments like telephones and things, and in listening to it back and watching the animation, it wasn't funny. It just didn't get a laugh. It was horrifying. And what we tried all sorts of experiments to try to make it funny, you know, crazier sound effects and this and that. And finally what we did is we pulled out all the sounds of exertion. So when Homer clonks Smithers on the head with a phone, he goes, ugh! And we took that out and we left in the Smithers sound of pain. And for some reason, the sound of pain, the sound of outrage, the sound of injury is funny. And the sound of anger and aggression is creepy and scary. And it's really funny.
You said that, you know, you go over the script and make check marks next to everything that gets a laugh. Who is getting the laugh from? Is it the other writers, or do you do this in front of a test audience?
Well, there are people who come to these table reads who are not writers. Writers all sit around one end of the table and just, you know, are listening, you know, have their heads tilted and see see what gets a laugh from the guests in the room. And there's a lot of people who work on the Fox lot who sneak in and they generally sit along one wall, and we call it the sour wall because they're often sitting there with their arms crossed, disapproving and shaking their heads at certain jokes. But if we can get the sour wall to laugh, then it's a good script.
My guest is Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons. Let's hear a scene from The Simpsons. Krusty the Clown has been invited to The Simpsons' house for dinner.
Krusty, would you do the honors?
Well, all right. I'm a little rusty, but I'll try. Baruch ata Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, hamotzi lechem, min haaretz.
Oh, he's talking funny talk.
No, Dad, that's Hebrew. Krusty must be Jewish.
A Jewish entertainer? Get out of here.
Dad, there are many prominent Jewish entertainers, including Lauren Bacall, Don Shore, William Shatner, and Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks is Jewish?
I want to ask you about some of the characters that didn't exist in the very beginning stages of The Simpsons, starting with Krusty the Clown, who's this really funny character. I mean, he's basically like an old vaudevillian type. He's kind of really bitter and Jewish, like a lot of comics, and but this is like an old style Jewish comic dash clown. What did you think of Krusty when he was first created?
Well, Krusty was based on a TV show clown who I grew up with in Portland, Oregon, named Rusty Nails. Rusty Nails was a Christian clown. He was he had his own show, and he showed old Three Stooges shorts, and he was great. And he wasn't like Krusty at all. He was very nice guy, and a very sweet clown. But he had that name, Rusty Nails, which I found incredibly disturbing as a child, because you're supposed to avoid Rusty Nails, so. So the idea of a clown named Rusty Nails.
You were a sensitive little kid.
Clowns are scary to begin with. And even though this was a nice clown, I was slightly perturbed by him. Anyway, so Krusty the Clown, Krusty rhymes with Rusty, and I actually created him as a little on-screen character on the Tracy Ullman show for those little shorts there. And the idea of the design of him is he actually is basically originally Homer in clown garb, and the satirical conceit that I was going for at the time was that the Simpsons was about a kid who had no respect for his father but worshipped a clown who looked exactly like his father. So but we sort of lost that, and I didn't make Krusty Jewish. That was Jay Kogan and Wally Walidarsky, I think, came up with that idea. Two of the old Simpsons writers, and then the rest is, he's one of the richest characters on the show. In fact, this year we have Krusty having his bar mitzvah, finally. Turns out he... And it's a pretty wild show.
My guest is Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons. Okay, let's talk about Itchy and Scratchy. And this is the recurring cartoon that Bart and Lisa watch on TV. And it's the kind of like super violent version of all the cat and mouse kind of cartoons. How'd you come up with this?
Well, it was from watching cat and mouse cartoons growing up. Pixie and Dixie, the Hanna-Barbera mice, and Tom and Jerry in particular, very, very violent and very, very funny cartoons, MGM cartoons. And the fantasy was seeing, wanting these cartoons to extend their violence even more. So with Itchy and Scratchy, it's probably as extreme as it can get for a cat and mouse cartoon. It's been really fun, because it turns out, the way these shows come together, that whatever the theme of that particular episode is of The Simpsons, there's some Itchy and Scratchy cartoon that obliquely relates to it. They're very hard to write now. We've done so many of them that they're harder and harder to write. And originally, of the actors, Harry Shearer, a sophisticated guy, he seemed to laugh the hardest at Itchy and Scratchy during the table reads. I think I don't know if he's the voice of Itchy or Scratchy, but he's the voice of one of them. He talks like that. Dan Castellaneta is the voice of the other one, the cat or the mouse. I don't know. I sometimes have difficulty remembering which is the cat. And then I go, oh, Scratchy, because he scratches. That's how I figure it out.
So were you in on the writing of the Itchy and Scratchy theme song?
That was obvious. It's by the way, it's not, everybody thinks it's they fight and fight and fight and fight and fight. It's not. It's they fight and bite and fight and fight and bite.
Do you remember the theme for Rough and Ready?
No, I don't. I loved Rough and Ready, another great Hanna-Barbera cartoon, but I don't remember.
Because the bridge was, sometimes they have their little spats. They even fight like dogs and cats, et cetera, et cetera. I was wondering if this was an homage to that at all, but I guess not.
I do have a lot of cartoon themes running through my head. In fact, over the years, I wake up out of a deep sleep with a specific theme running through my head. It's the end of, a local Portland, Oregon kids show, Heck Harper. He was a cowboy, and he used to sing, "Sadly now we bid adieu to all our barnyard friends. Rocky and Bullwinkle and Mr. Magoo, Felix and Popeye, I'll say toodaloo," or something like that. That's as far as I remember. But I wake up to that lots and lots of times. It's really, really...
sad.
A cause for concern.
Well, I think it's time to hear the Itchy and Scratchy theme song. Let's hear it.
The lyrics to that were written by Sam Simon, one of the original producers who developed the show, along with Jim Brooks, and basically set the tone for the show.
Okay, I have to ask you now about Troy McClure. I love the name, just like Troy Donahue and Doug McClure. A kind of like washed-up former handsome actor who's never been in really important movies. Can you talk about the creation of Troy McClure?
Well, Troy McClure was, he's a stand-in for a lot of exactly what you said, washed-up phony baloney Hollywood actors. And Phil Hartman, the great, late, great Phil Hartman, played Troy McClure and Lionel Hutz and a few other characters on the show. And what's great about Phil Hartman was that you could give him any line and he could figure out a way of pulling the maximum amount of humor out of it. And not only that, he was just a great person. It's easy to say that about people who have passed on, but I think everybody on the show would agree that Phil Hartman was always a delight to work with, and because he's gone, we have retired those characters. We don't want to revoice them.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Well, can I share my favorite Troy McClure moment? And I think this is a lot of people's favorite Troy McClure moments. He is engaged to one of Marge's sisters, and the sister knows that there's some kind of sexual secret that he's keeping from her, and she thinks that the secret is he's gay. But he says, "Do you want to do the line?"
I don't remember.
Oh, he says, "Gay? I wish." it turns out he has a really weird sexual fetish. That is an example of the type of thing that The Simpsons really gets away with. It's a kid show on the one hand, or at least a lot of kids watch it. A lot of adults watch it, too. But there's this really funny sexual humor on it.
What's the fetish? I don't remember. Was it
fish? Oh, I don't even remember either. I think it's a fish thing, yeah. It was just some kind of weird thing, but...
Yeah, that's the... Yeah, fish. That would make sense.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, do you ever get any problems coming back at you as a result of humor like that?
Well... You know, stuff that's so far-fetched like that is, we don't get much problem with that. We deal with various sexual aspects of contemporary culture and what I try to hope that we do is that the stuff that's not appropriate for kids, they don't get. Again, the idea of The Simpsons always has been that it's a show for everybody that is... for all ages, and not every joke is for every person. In fact, I always said, well, the dumb jokes, the ones that you don't think are funny, those are for the kids. And the sophisticated ones, the references to Dostoevsky and so on, those are for the grown-ups. And so the idea is to basically redefine family entertainment and do stuff for the entire family that you can all stand to sit there and watch. And how much of TV can you say that about? Most TV is so fragmented in the demographic that it's trying to get to that, there's very few things that that I can watch that my kids dig. So, but they do like The Simpsons.
The last time you were on Fresh Air, David Bianculli was guest hosting, our TV critic, And one of the things you said to him was that The Simpsons is about the anxiety and consternation of living with people who drive you out of your mind. How do you live with people you love and you want to kill? Do you still see it that way?
Wow. That sounds really smart.
Doesn't it?
that sounds true. That sounds it sounds like you're in a court and you're saying, "Did you say the following?" That's what it's about. I mean, that's at the core. It's about being in a family and families drive you crazy. So nothing changes about that. We can all relate to that, I'm sure.
Does that statement that I just read describe your family too?
Except for my family. Come on, what do you think? You know, my family hears this. And by the way, that interview that you mentioned, that was repeated a number of times, and I actually heard it with my kids in the car driving.
What was that like?
And it was a very odd sensation. And, of course, they take me to task for everything. And they're my most honest critics, and they give notes on the show, and I often quote my kids. I just actually sit there and take notes on their conversations at the dinner table, and run them in my strip, and hope that they don't sue me. No, they dig it. Although they're old now, they're 12 and 14, and they're much less cooperative about letting me write down what they say. But when they were younger, I got lots of material out of them.
Uh-huh. Matt Groening, so great to talk to you. Thank you very, very much.
Always a pleasure, Terry. Great show.
Matt Groening is the creator of The Simpsons. Our interview was recorded late last year. The fifth season of the series was just released on DVD. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Live from Springfield Penitentiary's fabulous big open area in Cell Block D, it's the Krusty the Clown Prison Special.
I slugged some jerk in Tahoe, they gave me 1 to 3. My high-priced lawyer sprung me on a technicality. I'm just visiting Springfield Prison, I get to sleep at home tonight. Hey, I kid because I love. I tell you, the best folk in the world are prison folk.
Man, those clowns love Krusty. Inside every hardened criminal beats the heart of a 10-year-old boy.
And vice versa.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Tree, a new vision of the American forest by photographer James Balog. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good. TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we listen back to interviews with novelist, essayist, and critic Susan Sontag and actor Jerry Orbach, who starred in Law and Order. They both died yesterday, Sontag of leukemia, Orbach of prostate cancer. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Susan Sontag died yesterday of complications of leukemia. She was 71. In the obituary, which ran on the front page of the New York Times, Sontag was described as, quote, the novelist, essayist, and critic whose impassioned advocacy of the avant-garde and equally impassioned political pronouncements made her one of the most lionized presences and one of the most polarizing in 20th century letters, unquote. In the late 70s, Sontag was diagnosed with breast cancer. She underwent chemotherapy and several operations. Her sickness led her to think about the punitive and sentimental images that we use to describe sick people and their illnesses. Those observations led to her 1978 book, Illness as Metaphor. In 1989, she wrote a follow-up called AIDS and Its Metaphors. When it was published, I asked her why she was still interested in analyzing the metaphors we use to discuss illness.
The metaphors are just ways of tracking attitudes. So what interests me, in fact, isn't, in this instance, verbal. I'm not that kind of linguistic purist. I'm not trying to make people clean up their language out of some idea of how language ought to be. What interests me is that metaphors and turns of speech are carriers of very deep attitudes, and it's the attitudes that matter. And a lot of the attitudes, I think, are wrong, false, misleading, and punishing, particularly to patients.
You wrote Illness as Metaphor after you had cancer. And
when I had cancer.
When you had cancer. What about the language that was used around you by your doctors, perhaps, started to make you really conscious of the language that we use to describe illness and people who are sick?
Well, I became a cancer patient in the late 70s, and my cancer was diagnosed as terminal, so I not only found out, to my surprise, I had cancer, I found out that I was going to die, which, as it turned out, I didn't. And the discovery was not even so much the language the doctors used, although I quickly became aware of that, too. It was when I started to live mainly in hospitals and I discovered how ashamed people with cancer were of the illness, how they concealed it from their employers and friends and family members. And it wasn't just an illness. It seemed to be some kind of embarrassment or scandal. And so that was indeed the origin of that book, which I thought was the last book I would ever write. But I did get very good treatment, and I was cured.
Did the doctors use language that you thought ended up victimizing you in some way or that you were uncomfortable with?
No, I don't. It really came... the doctors viewed me as odd, first of all, because I was asking for more treatment when they didn't want to give me a lot of treatment because they thought I was terminal, and also because I wanted to learn about the illness because I'm a naturally curious person. And they said, oh, you know, we've never seen somebody who was so interested. And I said, why shouldn't I be interested? I mean, as my life is on the line. And, well, usually people don't want to know about their treatment or about the illness. And I think that people are more curious about, let's say, diabetes or MS or heart or cardiac illness than they are about. They were really spooked by cancer. It's less true now, but it certainly was true 10 years ago when I was sick.
Why do you think it's less true now?
Well, for one thing, we have a more terrifying disease, a disease which is, I say in my new book, that it seems as if our society or our kind of society needs a disease which is demonized. And then, by extension, there is an imputation of fault or guilt to the patient. But although we need to do this with illnesses, make them symbolic or metaphoric and moralize about them, it's make them into a scandal. We perhaps only have place for one illness at a time, and that certainly was for generations cancer. And now I think it is AIDS. I think AIDS has become the great symbolic illness of our time, to which all sorts of interesting attitudes are attached, including our very attitudes toward the future and toward disaster and toward behavior of all kinds, which is why I thought it was worth writing another essay about, another small book about attitudes toward illness, because about AIDS as such, I don't think I have anything so original to say. I mean, it's a terrible disease. I've lost many friends to it. I think people should get good treatment. I think there is better treatment than most people are getting, et cetera, et cetera. I think there should be lots more money for research. Those are, you know, I have the standard, I think, correct attitudes that many other people have. The contribution that I can make in my book is to explore all the attitudes associated with this illness. Concerns about pollution, for instance, and contamination that reinforce the horror of the disease. I mean, the disease is bad enough. Any serious illness that's life-threatening is bad enough. But why should people feel guilty? Why should they feel as if they are carriers of evil? And they do. And they do with AIDS, and they have with cancer.
What language do you use to describe the fact that you don't have cancer anymore? And what I mean is, some people say, I triumphed over cancer. I fought the battle and won. You really hate military metaphors when it comes to disease, and that's something you point out in illness as metaphor and AIDS and its metaphors. So when you, if someone asks you about your condition and you say that you no longer have cancer, what words do you use?
Well, I say I was cured because I struggled with the help of friends to get into a very high-powered, advanced medical situation where I was in an experimental, you know, I was a guinea pig for some new drugs, which subsequently, of course, have been adopted, but they were still in an experimental stage. And I'm not averse to saying, I mean, I'm too modest, perhaps, in my language to want to say I triumphed about anything. That's not a word that comes easily to mind. To me, and you know, say I triumph, I tend to say, well, I did okay. But I would say I fought for my life. I did. I don't say I fought the disease because that sounds corny, but I would say I really wanted to live. I really wanted to live. I was in no way an accomplice of this disaster. I didn't say, you know, well, there's a part of me that doesn't want to live, and I wanted to do everything I could. I struggled. I don't think, you see, metaphors of struggle are wrong, because I think life is in part a struggle. I'm not against metaphoric language as such, but personally, of course, I have no difficulty in saying, yes, I fought for my life. I did.
A lot of people who have faced life-threatening illness and survive talk about how it really changed their lives, how their priorities changed, the way they spend their time changed. Did anything like that happen to you?
Absolutely. Oh, sure. It's absolutely a turning point in my life. I think it was actually a positive experience. It may sound strange to say it. There are a lot of things I didn't like about it, like scaring people who love me, particularly my son, who went into a sort of deep despair when he thought that I was going to die. And that was certainly a wound in his life. And I didn't like, you know, being cut up and mutilated in operations. And I didn't like a lot of other things. And yet, I think it was a positive experience. I think it was a deepening experience. It's put me more in contact with myself, and I don't think it didn't make me into a different person, but it released things that were inhibited, like I have more access to my own gift for intimacy, if I can put it in such an indirect and shy form. I find it easier and more necessary to express feeling for other people. I mean, I had those feelings, but I was more inhibited before. And when I was very ill, in the years I was very ill, I mostly spent that time holding hands, as it were. People gathered around me. They were wonderful. A number of people came through for me in the most magnificent way, and I felt that holding hands and being with people and laughing and crying together was a tremendous, exalting experience. I had just euphoric moments in this period of being ill. And people who were with me felt that, too. I mean,
So you've kept that intimacy.
I have, to some extent, right.
Why was it something that you didn't have before? Was it a time thing, or did you think that it was too sentimental to express intimacy that way?
I think I had a very emotionally very deprived childhood. I was left to myself when I was a child. I had my father died when I was 5, and I really never knew him, and my mother was away most of my childhood. So I think I have a little bit still, a bit the psychology of an orphan. And so I would be afraid of showing feeling because of being afraid of rejection. It's something so deep, you know, and so primal. You don't, you know it's not true, but somewhere deep down, you just don't feel that people are going to love you, because if you didn't feel loved when you were 2 or 3 years old, it's very hard to come to that later on. It's a kind of acquired confidence. I see my son, for instance, who knows himself to have been much loved when he was a small child. He's now an adult. He just has a different way of relating to people. I mean, because there's some basic confidence that you have when you feel that you're loved when you're a very tiny child that you can't have. Or anyway, you have to do a lot of work to acquire it. And I had to do a lot of work. I'm in my 50s now, and I think I'm just beginning, and partly due to my illness experience, to get over the wounds of that sort of feeling of being an orphan or being an abandoned or rejected child.
Susan Sontag, recorded in 1989. We'll listen back to an excerpt of a 1993 interview with Sontag after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering essayist, novelist, and critic Susan Sontag. She died yesterday of leukemia. In 1993, during the war in the Balkans, Sontag risked her life by going to Sarajevo, where she directed a production of Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. She found only 2 existing theaters and no functioning theater companies. After she returned, she spoke to Fresh Air guest host Marty Moscoane.
How multi-ethnic was the cast and the crew? Were there Muslims, Croats, Serbs working together on this play?
Absolutely, and I made no effort to choose people on that basis, but gradually as I got to know them, I found that I had, you know, absolutely a mix. I had people who were completely Serb, completely of Muslim origin, and completely Croat, and I had more than half the people who were of mixed parentage, a Muslim mother and a Serb father, or Croat mother and a Muslim father, et cetera. It was because that's what Sarajevo is. And one of the most interesting facts about Sarajevo that I know is in the year before the war started, in April 92, 60% of the marriages in Sarajevo were intermarriages. I think that tells you a lot about the city.
What language, then, was the play done in?
The play was done in Bosnian because that's the language the actors speak, although many of them do speak English. They don't act in English, and anyway, the audience, I want this play to be understood by the audience. That may seem odd to you, but it's really not odd. I mean, Arthur Miller went to Shanghai and directed a production of Death of a Salesman. He certainly directed it in Chinese, not in English. So just a theater director, like an opera director with any experience and any international experience, knows how to do this in a foreign language. All you need is an interpreter. And I used one of the actors who was bilingual as my interpreter. And I could communicate privately with most of the actors in English. But the language in which they spoke the text was Bosnian. And what I did was I had 2 copies of the script. I had an English language copy of Mr. Beckett's script enlarged. And I wrote the Bosnian word by word above the English, and then I had a copy of the Bosnian text, and I wrote the English above it word by word. And after about 2.5 weeks, I could recite the play for you in Bosnian because I heard it so many times. And I always knew what they were saying, and I could say, you know, that line you're saying too fast or not expressively or whatever. It's no different, really, from opera directing, which also takes place in many languages.
What was it like to work with a cast and crew that I'm sure were hungry a lot of the time, certainly were frightened a lot of the time, probably many of them didn't even feel well because of the conditions they were living under?
Yeah, what it was is that I was pretty easygoing at the start, and maybe I was easygoing all the way through, keeping my fingers crossed that I'd still get a good result at the end. One or two people said to me, who came in and watched rehearsals. It's funny, I've never told this to anybody. He said, you're too nice to them. Don't you know a director has to scream at people now and then and be terrifying and tyrannical?
Are you that kind of a director anyway?
Well, first of all, I'm neither that kind of director nor that kind of person. But I knew that I couldn't scream at these people, even if I wanted to. They were so gallant and so tired, and they all had terrible stories. And I noticed how tired they were because they would sit down or lie down every time I stopped the rehearsal for 1 minute to give a correction or suggestion. They'd immediately all drop into chairs or drop to the floor. And actors don't do that. I mean, they stay in place when you talk to them, unless it goes on and on and on. And I wasn't stopping them for more than a minute or two.
So they had no stamina, really.
They had no stamina at all. And the character of Lucky in Beckett's play is a figure of a man who carries a lot of suitcases. He's the figure of a burdened person. And needless to say, the suitcases that the actor playing Lucky in my production was carrying were all empty. And he was having a very hard time carrying empty, very light suitcases, two or three.
You certainly are describing the desperate conditions in Sarajevo and describing the deep depression that many of the people feel. How are they able to go on with their life? How much of a life do they really have?
Well, you know, as many people have said in literature and in ordinary life, people get used to anything. This is both a horrible and an exalting aspect of human nature. You would be surprised at the degree of normality there. I remember when I went in April, I couldn't believe that I saw children playing on the streets. And I met parents, and I said, how do you let your children go out on the streets? Because something like 3 or 4 children are minimum are killed every day by sniper bullets or by mortar shells fragments. And they said, look, you can't keep your children indoors after 16 months. You can keep them indoors for 2 weeks or a month or 2 months, but life goes on, except it's Russian roulette. It's a shooting gallery, except you could be killed at any single moment of the day or night, wherever you are, and you have in almost all places in the city, including the one functioning hotel, which is where I stayed, no water at any time, no electricity at any time, and very, very little food.
What precautions did you take to make sure that, not make sure, but to try to protect yourself against the sniper bullets?
None.
None? Why not? Why not?
Because I think I cannot work with people there wearing a flak jacket. I will tell you, I do own one. Because in order to get on a UN plane, which is the only way you can get in or out of the city, is by a plane run by the United Nations, which carries soldiers or cargo, it's a rule that you have to wear a flak jacket. So I actually possess one of these things. I wore it to get on the plane in Zagreb, and I got off the plane with it at the Sarajevo airport, which is controlled by the Serbs. But there's a little UN revetment, and I wore it into the city, and I checked into the hotel, and I left it there, and I put it on again 6 weeks later when I went out to the airport to get on the plane. That may seem very foolish, but I felt that I could not come to rehearsal, sit with my actors wearing armor, when no one in the city has a flak jacket, and no one is protected in the way all foreigners, that is journalists or anybody visiting the city, is. So that was a moral decision. I felt like I absolutely could not do that, that I'm putting myself in a different position. No one told me to do that except one actor about 4 days into the rehearsal process said to me, of course, I wouldn't mind if you wore a flak jacket, but I do appreciate that you don't. But that was the only person who ever said to me that noticed it. But I'm sure everybody noticed it. I felt it was a question of principle, not to live differently from the way they live.
Susan Sontag speaking with Fresh Air guest host Marty Moscowane in 1993. Sontag died yesterday of complications from leukemia. She was 71. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with actor Jerry Orbach. He died last night of prostate cancer. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Actor Jerry Orbach died last night of prostate cancer. He was 69. He's best known today for his role as the hardened, wisecracking detective Lenny Briscoe on the long-running, much-syndicated TV drama Law & Order. But his resume includes a number of starring roles in musicals, such as The Fantastics, Carnival, 42nd Street, Chicago, and Promises, Promises, for which he won a Tony. His movies include Dirty Dancing and Crimes and Misdemeanors. When he fell ill, he had already begun production on the Law & Order spinoff, Law & Order Trial by Jury. He's expected to appear in the early episodes of the show this season. Lenny Briscoe isn't the first cop Orbach played. In the 1981 film Prince of the City, Orbach was Gus Levy, a corrupt cop who refuses to cooperate with a commission investigating members of the narcotics squad on the take. Before we listen to the interview I recorded with Orbach in 1989, let's hear a scene from Prince of the City.
You indict me on a squawk of a dope dealer who tried to buy me out of a bust? You want to break up another federal operation that'll put away more quality mob guys in a year than you'll touch in your whole pissant career?
Detective Levy, you're hardly in a position...
I'll tell you what I'm in a position to do, and that's throw you out the window. It's only the fifth floor, but I'll try to aim you so you land on your pointed little head.
Levy, you can easily avoid trial. All you have to do is cooperate.
You got your mind made up to try me? Go ahead and try me. But not for a lousy $400. At least get me for assault.
Now, in this scene where you've just overturned the investigator's desk and then hit him real hard, it's very menacing.
Yes.
In that scene. Did you feel well-suited to that kind of menacing performance?
Oh, I love it because, you know, in real life, you can't go around throwing people's desks over and hitting them or kneeing them in the groin. You'll get sued. So to play that kind of a scene is a wonderful release for anybody. Because we have so many frustrations. There are people we'd like to hit, but we can't really do that. Also, it was a great release for the audience, because in Prince of the City, the prosecutors are very dry and very nasty, and, you know, they just don't give an inch to anybody. And it was sort of, the audience got its revenge on those guys for a minute there when I did that. It was a release for the audience.
You actually got your start in musicals. As a matter of fact, why don't I play something here from 42nd Street?
I'm sorry, show business isn't for me. I'm going back to Allentown.
What was that word you just said? Allentown? I'm offering you a chance to star in the biggest musical Broadway scene in 20 years, and you say Allentown? Come on along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway. The hip hooray and ballyhoo. Lullaby of Broadway, the rumble of the subway train, the rattle of the taxis, the daffodils who entertain at Angelo's and Maxie's when a Broadway baby.
I've read about you that your heroes when you were getting started were James Dean, Marlon Brando, Montgomery Clift. They didn't do musicals with the exception of Brando's Guys and Dolls. Was it your ambition to do musicals when you were starting out?
It's funny. I always sang and loved singing, and I studied it. I came to New York after I got out of Northwestern. I was a very serious young actor. And did study with Lee Strasberg, Herbert Berghoff, Mira Rostova, worked at the Actors Studio. But the first job I got in New York was to replace the street singer in Threepenny Opera. And I actually then replaced McKeith, Mac the Knife, for about 6 months, worked with Lenya and everything. And I went from three and a half years in the Threepenny Opera to originate El Gallo in The Fantastics, which gave me a springboard to Broadway in a show called Carnival. And I just kept going from one show to another, from one musical to another, and it was a terrific life. My kids were being born, and I was raising a family in New York. And all my friends who couldn't sing, who were desperate and out of work, couldn't get a job off Broadway or anything, all went to Hollywood. And some of them became big stars out there. And that's sort of what I had wanted to do, you know, in the background. I'd always wanted to do that, work in film. And it just didn't seem to work out that way. I kept working, and it was all right.
It's interesting to me that you got your start in Three Penny Opera. It seems like the perfect place for you, since it was a musical, but it was also a menacing musical. So,
yes, well, I had done the first American production of the Caucasian Chalk Circle at Northwestern, and I was very, very steeped in Brecht and pretty knowledgeable about Brecht's work and everything. So when I went to meet the director of Three Penny, and we chatted for a little while, and he gave me the job right away.
What kinds of roles did you think you were heading for when you were getting started? What did you think that your specialty was going to be?
I really didn't know I'd have any kind of a specialty. I thought I'd be a leading man, you know, and I was never a juvenile, even when I was 19 or 20. I mean, at 20, I was playing Mac the Knife opposite Lenya, which was outrageous. You know, I had no business being there, but I never looked like a kid. So it took me till I was into my mid-20s to start to really get the roles that I looked like. You know, I should have been 30, 35 playing them.
Did that seem like a hardship at the time, that you didn't look like a kid when you were a kid?
I don't know, not really. But sometimes I'd think, you know, the sort of Tab Hunter, Tony Curtis types, you know, I said, well, I can never compete with them, you know, back in the late 50s, because I was a little offbeat.
But of course, then their careers sometimes end early because...
Yes, I found that out.
Yeah.
Longevity is in being a character, man. Somebody said, are you ever going to retire? I said, no, I want to be like Melvin Douglas playing the grandpa on my deathbed when I'm about 85. That would be a pleasure.
Jerry Orbach, recorded in 1989. He died yesterday of prostate cancer. He was 69. We'll close with Orbach singing on the original Broadway cast recording of Chicago. He played an opportunistic lawyer, the role that was played in the film adaptation by Richard Gere. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Is everybody here? Is everybody ready? Hit it! I don't care about expensive things. Cashmere coats, diamond rings don't mean a thing. All I care about is love. That's what I'm here for. I don't care for wearing silk cravats, ruby studs, satin spats don't mean a thing. All I care about is love.
All he cares about is love.
Give me two eyes of blue, softly saying I need you. Let me see.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publisher of Tool and Die, A Home Repair is Homicide Mystery by Sarah Graves, author of Mallets of Forethought. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our end-of-the-year series, Last Laughs. We'll hear from Mort Saul. He pioneered a new kind of stand-up comedy in the 60s based on the headlines of the day. And Dave Chappelle talks about his life and his popular show on Comedy Central. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.